Blind Nil Audio.
Hey, it's Carl. What do you think of when I say the word psychopath? Whatever comes to mind, I promise that you'll be surprised by today's guest. Jamie is a self-declared and diagnosed psychopath. She doesn't use her last name publicly to protect the privacy of family members, but she has written a book about her experience under a pseudonym. I have to admit that I went into this conversation with a lot of misunderstanding about what psychopathy even is. But I hope that listening to my conversation with Jamie will clear up any misconceptions you might have about psychopathy. And I hope it opens our minds to the fresh perspective that neurodiversity can bring to any conversation, including those about money. And when you experience the power of Jamie's drive and conviction, especially when it comes to saving and investing, you just might find yourself wanting to be a little bit more like a psychopath. I know I did. I'm Carl Richards, an author, artist, and certified financial planner, and you're listening to 50 Fires, a podcast about money and meaning. So tell me, how did you get invited to do this? Like, to come have a conversation about money. That's not something we normally say yes to.
Well, I would say yes to it because I have like a very good relationship with money.
What does that mean?
You know, money, like growing up, I saw the way that adults around me, especially my parents, were with money. And I thought, why is this so hard for them? You know, it was like kind of feast and famine, you know, like we would go to like Universal Studios and then come home. And the electricity would be out because, you know, my dad, and I, it was not until adulthood that I learned you have to stop paying for like several months before they cut your electricity. Like, yeah. That's a pretty unusual thing. It's not like something that you can just, oh, I accidentally forgot to drop off the check or whatever in the mail. It's like something that you're actively kind of juggling these obligations and feeling like you don't want to put money where it should go to solve your problems. Instead, you want to take that money and do something else with it. And I just thought it seemed really disordered. Like, how does somebody get there? You know, how do you just kind of like turn over your kind of autonomy to like this kind of monster that sometimes people see money as? And maybe that's kind of why I have the good relationship with money. But it could also be that I am a psychopath is why I have this good relationship with money.
Yeah. Tell me about the word psychopath.
So psychopath, it's just a personality disorder. And it shares a lot in common with a lot of the other personality disorders, including borderline personality disorder, narcissistic personality disorder, and the kind of the qualities that you would expect to see in any personality disorder is that somebody just has a bad relationship, kind of connection to their identity, to their personality. And the thing with psychopathy, as I come to understand it, is psychopaths just have a very weak sense of self.
So when you use the word, maybe it's because I'm a psychopath, you're not just saying, maybe it's because I'm crazy with money. You're saying you're a psychopath.
Yeah. So that I'm glad you brought that up because that's kind of one of the reasons why I used the word sociopath for a while is because I think the word psycho or psychopath has come to be known. Maybe it's the Alfred Hitchcock movie. It's come to be known as just kind of crazy, but it's not psychotic. Like all personality disordered people will experience distortions of reality. You know, they'll see the world in a disordered way.
Yeah.
But they're not psychotic. They're not hallucinating. You know, they're not, seeing things, you know, like hearing voices or something like that.
Yeah, but to be clear, you're saying you are a psychopath or sociopath, depending on how you, either one of those. You're saying I have been diagnosed as that thing.
Yes. So.
And wrote a book about it.
Yeah, wrote a book about it.
So talk to me about just the connection between how you feel and interact with money and this idea of psychopathy.
Yeah. So I would say that all psychopaths are different. You know, I should clarify that first. So I'm mostly speaking from my own personal experience.
But sure.
I'll try to highlight, though, a little bit of the things that I think are common, very common among psychopaths. Although the way that they would manifest themselves with regard to money, I think really kind of depends because, you know, you see you know, psychopaths, like among the richest CEOs and among like the homeless, you know, cannot hold a job type people. So there's a wide spectrum in which it manifests itself. But the two primary characteristics I think that are relevant when it comes to money are the ability to compartmentalize and impulsivity. So I think one thing that I was able to do, and this kind of highlights both, is by the time I was 30, I had already fully funded my retirement. And that was just because in law school, I was exposed to kind of like richer people. Kind of reminds me of like rich dad, poor dad or whatever. you get exposed to richer people. And you just learn that there are kind of just different ways that money can be used, I guess. And so I looked at their stuff and I looked at kind of the stuff that I had been exposed to before. And I just thought, okay, you know, the best use for money when you're in your early 20s is to just put it in a traditional Roth account, you know, fully maximize it and keep doing that for 5 years, because I was so compelled by the idea of compounding interest. I thought, oh, you know, the easiest way to get $1 million is to just invest basically like $25,000 and just wait 40 years. That's the easiest way. You know, not to work for it.
Wait, let's just back up. You're so compelled that in your 20s, the best use of money was just to fund your retirement.
Yeah.
Like that is not a sentence I've ever heard anybody say before, right? Obviously it makes sense, but most people say the best use of money in my 20s is to spend it on having a good time, right? Like you're not thinking about that future self. And you're just saying you looked around and said, well, that doesn't make sense.
I guess I thought I was having a good enough time as it was. You know, I already was having a good time. So I just, you know, you're not supposed to say stuff like this, but I just took out extra money in my student loans and thought, you know, I'll make this much back and, you know, this low rate of payment or something. And so, yeah, I did that. I just, well, it made the most sense to me because the other thing about it is like, as kind of a psychopath, I learned not really to trust myself, you know, because I'd be like, yeah, clipping along, you know, doing something and then like, you know, just suddenly feel like I can't be bothered with a job or I can't be bothered with like an educational program and then just drop it. Can't be bothered with a relationship. And it would just be as if the thing had never happened. And that's kind of the compartmentalization. Mm. Like it's so easy to just kind of move on. So I think thinking about like, what happens if like I'm old? What happens if I'm like 70 and I've totally ruined my life? I should at least kind of give myself like a fallback plan to where all I have to do is just, you know, reach 65 and I'll be okay. You know, I just have to kind of figure things out because, you know, you're so vulnerable when you're 65. When I was young, I even had like a good brain for things. You know, I could do things like take tests well and stuff. Now I'm old and my brain's decrepit. So I'm really glad I did all those things when I was young and I had excess resources. It seemed like I had excess brain power. I had excess money. I really didn't need all those things. And so I thought, well, let's just kind of like make a few moves now. But I also think this is why I say impulsivity came into it too. But first, let me kind of define the way that I use impulsive or the way I experience it as a psychopath. When I think of impulsivity, I have these recurring dreams. I've probably dreamt this like 100 times where I'm driving a car, but I'm not in the driver's seat. I'm actually in the back seat, like behind the driver. And I keep thinking to myself, how am I driving this car? Like I can barely see, you know, there's like a seat in front of me. I can't even see the car in front of me. I can't reach the brake. Like I feel like I have no control, but I know I'm driving. You know, nobody else is driving. It's me driving, but I just feel like I'm distanced from the decision. I'm not really, you know, able to control whatever is happening. And that's how I experience the like psychopathic impulsivity is like I'm in the back seat, but I'm still driving. But who's driving is I don't know, you know.
How did we get down this road? And why is nobody touching the brakes yet? Or just you're just going.
Yes. But when it came to saving the money for the retirement, stuff like that is actually helpful because I just got like obsessed with the idea of compounded interest. And then I just made the impulsive decision to fully fund my Roth account, you know, for the next few years. And when you do it, you can do the year before usually too.
Yeah.
So that's what I just did. I was like, you know, it was however much money, like 8,000 at the time because of the limits. And I was like, I'll just write out a check to Fidelity. you know.
How did you get obsessed with compound interest?
I think when the summer before I went to law school, I was learning a little bit about the stock market, because the rich people that I was around, that's what they did at the time. They would just give me books to read. And so I'd read the book and I... Family friends.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you got books about investing. Mm-hmm. That got you obsessed with compound interest.
Well, I learned that even if you take any 30 years of the market, even when you include the Great Depression or the Great Recession or any of those things, if you take any 30 years... the market never has underperformed. I think it's below 8%. Mm. Yeah. So any 30 years of the past since we basically had like publicly traded markets or whatever.
Or at least it's never been negative for a 30-year period, whatever that number was.
Between... No, it's crazier than that. You can look it up.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah. If you have to like keep it during that 30-year period, you know, like if you take just a 10-year period, sure.
Sure.
Then you might have like negative. But if you take 30 years, like even if there's a huge negative, it eventually will correct or whatever.
Yeah.
We'll keep going back up till I think the lowest 30-year period was something like in the high 6% or something. The absolute lowest. And you had to cherry pick the numbers like crazy. Yeah. In order to get it. But then other than that, it was just like, this is like the surest thing, whatever. And so you just take that 8%, which is like a very reasonable number if you're like planning on saving for 40 years, you know, and then you just like, you do the compound interest. And that was like, you know, compound interest for 8% of 25, you know, for 40 years. Yeah, you are a millionaire. Like that is just like the way the math works out.
So you did that math. Mm-hmm. And that's how you got obsessed.
For me.
Yeah, you read that and you were like, oh my gosh, then why not do that?
Yeah.
And then got impulsive about that.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just going to do that.
Yeah, I was so fixated by this idea that like, wow, I'll be a millionaire. Like what, and kind of like daydreaming about it. Like, what can I spend that $1 million on, you know?
Wow. Yeah, that's a very unique, right? Like the idea of connecting with a future self. Normally, when we think about a future self 30 years out, 25 years out, that connection is the equivalent of a stranger. And so we're not willing to make choices for the benefit of that future self because we have no connection to it. And you just essentially said, well, that makes sense. I'm going to do that thing.
I think the thing that I liked about it was less that I'm doing it for this future self and more that it was just an extremely powerful way to use money.
Interesting.
Yeah. Like it just seemed leveraged, you know, like I'm taking $25,000, which is nothing, you know, like, which is maybe, you know, at the time my rent for a year, which seemed little to me, you know, like I can just kind of collect it or whatever here or there. Over 5 years, you know, and then it's going to be $1 million. That seemed crazy to me. I was like, that's almost like magic.
Yeah. Yeah. People have described compound interest as almost like magic.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing. So circle back real quick to this term monster that like you said, you remember looking at adults, particularly your parents, and saying, why was this so hard for them? And then mentioning that sometimes people seem to make out money as this sort of monster. Like, what did you mean by that?
For my parents, it seemed to just be so emotionally fraught. It seemed like almost the most emotionally fraught thing that they experienced in their lives.
Was, you know, money.
Yeah, money.
Their relationship with money.
Yeah, because it was more than their family. You know, they have kind of ups and downs, bad family experiences or whatever. You know, like abuse, like childhood abuse. Like they felt worse about money than like their childhood abuse. Like it seemed, money seemed to be almost kind of just like to represent all potential risk in life to them.
Hey, it's Carl. This idea of money being a monster, I've never heard it put that way. But it's such an incredibly impactful visual to me of this problem that I've had, where I've given money a job it cannot do, right? Like I've expected money to make me feel happy. And then when it doesn't, I feel threatened by it. So what Jamie's saying is, geez, anything you feel threatened by, we could call a monster, right? So what I'm curious about is, you know, it turns out money can't really be a monster unless we allow it to be. And as soon as you shine light in the closet, you remember this, right? There's a monster in the closet. Mom and dad come in, they flip on the light. There's no monster there. And what's been really helpful to me since this conversation is to look at the ways in which I've allowed money to become threatening to me. Because it turns out money can't really be a monster unless I allow it to. So you've since the book, and by the way, I'm curious, what should I call you as we're talking?
So I wrote the book under a pseudonym. And part of the reason why is because I wasn't telling my story exclusively. You know, it was also my siblings, and they, you know, this was in, I think it came out in 2013, you know, so they were just starting careers. They had kids, younger kids, and my parents were still, you know, younger. They were still like kind of in their career. And I didn't want to kind of bring anything negative to them if I could avoid it. Mm. So I wrote the book under a pseudonym. You know, there's some very private details that I share about them.
Yes, there are.
Yeah. And I just thought, you know, this is the best way to try to be careful with those kind of private details. But since, you know, I think a few things have shifted. One is that I actually do think that the stigma about psychopathy has reduced. I don't know if it's like the new generation, you know, cares less about it, or like wokeness or whatever it is, you know, like just we've gotten better about kind of understanding autism, and we've gotten better about understanding, you know, people who are transgender, and we've gotten better at understanding a lot of other kind of different types of people. And I haven't specifically seen a movement for psychopathy, but it seems like people are kind of like, well, this is just a mental health disorder. Like, people cannot help being the way that they are.
Right.
And that same sort of logic that they've kind of learned from other, I guess, populations, that I think they've applied it to psychopathy. So that's one reason I've gotten more flexible. You know, I'll like make video appearances. You know, I'll use my own name, which is Jamie, and you can call me Jamie.
What was the pseudonym?
M.E. Thomas.
That's right. Yeah. M.E. Thomas. Since the book, you've spent, as I understand it, some time traveling, meeting other psychopaths. Mm-hmm. What have you noticed as a common thing, other than impulsivity and compartmentalization? What have you noticed? Like, what are interesting? I'd be super curious if there are some interesting financial stories about how people behave with money that you could share.
So I do think, you know, the common traits for psychopathy, like the very most kind of dominant ones, are a lack of empathy, and specifically a lack of affective empathy, to where, you know, whatever that emotional response that people get with empathy, where you feel you're actually, you know, you see somebody who's sad and you feel sad, that's missing. And people suspect that it may be mirror neurons, you know, in our brain that are kind of triggering those responses in us. We see sad, we get sad ourselves. And the psychopaths just don't experience that. And I still don't experience that, even though I've gone through therapy. You know, there's like a lot of stuff that has changed as I've kind of treated my personality disorder, and mostly by shoring up my sense of self, you know, by having a better connection to my identity, stronger emotional connection, you know, really feeling my emotions, all those types of things. But after all the years of therapy, I still don't experience affective empathy. But I do experience cognitive empathy. Like, I can just put myself in other people's shoes and be like, oh, you know, that bad thing happened to that person, that would suck, you know?
Right. So that's called cognitive empathy.
Yeah, cognitive empathy.
Theoretical empathy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And this empathy piece, this lack of empathy, shows up with money. Is that?
I actually think like the emotional disconnect in general shows up with money in a weird way, either lack of empathy or just kind of lack of, like, the reason why they're not, I think, connected to the emotions of other people is not because they don't care about other people. It's because they're not connected to their own emotions. Like, they're just disconnected from emotions. So it wouldn't make sense that they're not feeling their own, but they're somehow feeling yours.
You
know, like, I think that's the cause.
Yeah.
And but the weird things that happen when you're like not emotionally attached to money, I guess, are things like, you know, fully funding your retirement. But I also know a psychopath who
I'm tempted to say fully funding your retirement at age 20 is
30.
By age 30. Is the hallmark of a psychopath.
Yeah. But I know somebody else who just is like such a car aficionado that he owns like 6 cars, even though, you know, and they're all nice. They're all like you know, performance cars, but he can't afford them. And so he just kind of like gets one repossessed and then like buys another somehow.
Yeah.
Like that's also kind of the hallmark, I guess, of a psychopath with money, is that you're not worried too. You're kind of like not anything. You're not happy with the money necessarily. You're not worried about the money. So when the money kind of leaves, you're not worried. Like sometimes I think worry and fear can make people make kind of, you know, objectively better choices with money, right? You're so worried about being vulnerable that you hoard money, right? Even to the point where it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
You know?
Interesting.
Yeah. So it's just like the dysfunction shows up in almost opposite ways. Like in every way that like being emotional about money is either good or bad, you'll see the flip with a psychopath because they're not emotional about money.
We'll be right back with more from 50 Fires. Hey, it's Carl. You know what's hard for most of us? Talking money. That's what I'm talking about. Talking about money is hard for most of us, but there's somebody who it is not hard for. She's been doing it forever. Her name is Shauna Game. And if you've been enjoying the conversations I am having here at 50 Fires, I think you would love what Shauna's got going on at her podcast. The podcast is called Everyone's Talking Money. And just like 50 Fires, Shauna's goal with Everyone's Talking Money is to go beyond the spreadsheets and the calculators and the budgeting apps to talk about how our emotional relationship with money impacts our lives. With over 900 episodes, that's right, 900, there is an episode for any and every practical money question you have. Some of Shauna's recent episodes include retirement risks to avoid and credit card versus debit card. Which one should I use? You're going to love it. Subscribe to Everyone's Talking Money on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to 50 Fires. I'm curious about what you see non-psychopaths doing with money where you're just like, that makes no sense to me. I do not understand that behavior.
So I think for me, I don't experience any sort of boost from just spending money. Like that's one thing that I have noticed in other people where I just don't understand it at all. You know, where they'll get like Amazon packages. Like I have a relative and they have like in their house just stacks of unopened Amazon boxes.
No, that's crazy.
Yeah, it seems crazy to me, but it's because they're like on one, you know, on a Wednesday or something, they're, you know, they feel like they need like whatever the newest cute something, phone accessory or whatever it is, a book, you know, they get pleasure from like clicking buy more than they get pleasure from like actually using the thing. You know, they get the pleasure from the actual spending of the money. And that I don't get. I guess maybe
like it literally doesn't register for you at all.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, and maybe one of the reasons, maybe to say that it doesn't register at all is inaccurate. Like it probably registers for me 2 out of 10. And the only reason I kind of know this is because I do intentionally set my, like my payments, like credit card payments or whatever for automatic. Because it's not that it doesn't register for me at all. It's more like I don't want my mental energy kind of spent in those ways. I don't find it fruitful. Maybe. So yeah, I do. I experience something from it, but I dislike it. I dislike the thing that I'm experiencing because it's like, well, I don't want to have to, you know, spend my time thinking about like these like little things or, you know, little purchases. Like I shop at Costco for groceries like once a month. And I have like this Costco diet in which I eat like the rotisserie chicken and all the fresh fruits and vegetables in the order of perishability.
And you call this your Costco diet?
Yes.
And then, do you have like a list? Like when you go to Costco, you do this thing and then you go home and you eat this way.
Yes, exactly.
In the order of perishability.
Yeah, and it's always the same. Every month it's like basically the same foods. Yeah, where I'm like eating the fresh fruits and vegetables. Well, apples you can eat like 2 or 3 weeks later or something, right?
Right.
And then by the third week or fourth week, you're eating canned things, right? That's just kind of the Costco diet.
So smart.
Then go to Costco again.
One time.
Yeah, and repeat. Yeah, because I don't like to go to grocery stores. I actually think grocery stores, for some reason, like there, it must be because of my food traumas or something. I'm like, this is like a racket. They're exploiting you because they know that you need constant nourishment. And so here they are charging, you know, this amount for, you know, a thing of apples. Come on, you know.
So you've just dealt with that by making this Costco routine.
Yeah.
The Costco ritual.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I think in general, I don't like to actively deal with money because I think it kind of triggers in me, like if I'm the same way with my stocks, you know, like in my, I just trade in my retirement account and like very hands off, you know, but if I kind of think about it, then, you know, I don't want to kind of get obsessed and fixated. And I think there's like, there's definitely something about thinking about money too much. And that's why I like the impulsivity of it, because I think, so I imagine like a normal person, you know, would they be able to fully fund their retirement by the age that they're 30?
No. The answer to that question is no.
But I think one of the reasons why is because they overthink it, you know, like it's on their mind too much. They're not able to disconnect from it, to just do the thing and be done with it. Like right. I am because
I read the thing about compounding. That makes sense. Do the thing.
Yeah. And then just be done with it. And then like never think about it again.
Yeah.
Like the last time I thought about my stocks was a couple years ago. And then the time before that, like about my retirement, it was like 8 years before that. And I was, so 2 years ago, I looked at it, I was shocked to see how much money was in my retirement accounts. And I thought, have I overfunded it? You know, like, am I going to hit 59 and a half and just have way too much money?
Right. So let me just make sure I understood something. You just said 3 years ago and the time before that was 8 years. So in 11 years, looked at it twice.
Probably. Yeah. Yeah. And it's better that way. It's so much.
Of course it's better that way.
Yeah.
Everybody, it's settled doctrine at this point that it's better that way.
Well, it's better financially, but it's better also for my brain.
For everything. Yeah. And no one does it.
Yeah. Because I would rather just, you know, talk to you or talk to my friends or, you know, go for a walk than like sit there worrying or thinking, even thinking about it.
And so the idea that somebody else checks 3 times a day on their phone, you're just like, I don't understand.
Yeah, I don't understand because what are they gaining from that? Like, what are they seeking
Absolutely nothing, except some misery.
Like, that's it is misery. Sure. It's 100%. A recipe for misery. It's like the same for people. I feel the same about relationships, like the same people who check up on their like significant other multiple times a day. Like if I have something to share, you know, then I will contact my significant other. If I do not, then I'm not like checking in on them. You know, like I don't get that.
Right.
They're not like a dog, you know, they don't need to be like walked three times a day or something, you know?
Right. You do not need to walk your significant other 3 times a day.
No, or monitor what they're doing, or I don't know if it's jealousy or something. Like if I'm, and that I think too is like this kind of attentional thing that I experience with the psychopathy where, and they have done studies about this where, have you ever seen these cartoons where old cartoons, Looney Tunes, they're like escaping from prison usually and there's a spotlight. And the whole screen's black, like these black and white cartoons, unless the spotlight is on the character and then you can see the character.
Oh, yeah.
And then the spotlight goes to other things and you can't see the character. That's what my attention is like. If the spotlight's on the thing, then okay, I see it. I'm aware of it. That's my tendency. And if the spotlight's not on the thing, then I'm able to compartmentalize it away. You know, it's as if the thing doesn't exist. Now, interestingly, as I have done therapy, I have been less good about compartmentalizing. Like that's become a skill that I've had to kind of actively practice. And so now I have these cheats, normal people cheats, I guess, to achieve the same effect.
Normal people cheats.
Yeah, which is like meditation, mindfulness. And I have like hard rules, super hard rules that I won't do certain things. Like I don't look at my email past like 6 p.m. Like, and I don't.
Now, let me ask you a question. Everybody says that. Mm-hmm. Do you or do you not look past 6 p.m.?
I'm so zero interested. If somebody, I tell people too, like if this is kind of something that, you know, like I think is might be an urgent thing or pop up, I say, if you want to get a hold of me, you will need to text because I will not look at my email. Like 6 p.m. is a hard cutoff. Usually it's like 5:30 or 5 or something. Okay. And I don't look at my email until like 1:30 p.m.
What are some of the other normal people cheats?
So other normal people cheats is just kind of like in the moment, you know, let's say I'm going for a walk. It's like, what do I feel on my skin? What do I, you know, like trying to kind of hyper focus in that moment. Whereas before, you know, like when I was like a baby psychopath, that was just the natural way of being, is that I was just very much in the moment. That was like the great thing about being like a young psychopath is you're like hardly concerned about anything. It's just easy to compartmentalize right to the nth degree and just not worry about the future, not worry about the past, like zero worry.
Tell me about life now for you. You live down in North County.
Yes.
San Diego, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, and spend time on the beach and travel. Like, what does life look like for you right now?
So, I mean, I think I've mentioned earlier, like my willpower, everybody has finite willpower, but even I maybe have even more finite or something. I'm just very careful how I spend it. And I will not put myself in situations that are unsustainable is kind of like the way that I think of life. So I'm always refusing to be in a job I don't like or to work for people I don't like. And I don't know why, but it's worked out really well. Right. It's worked out like absolutely great. Like I am a lawyer and I work at the beach. I used to work at the beach.
What do you mean you work at the beach?
Like I just bring my laptop.
To the beach?
Yeah. Okay. And probably like 3 hours maybe of work a day. That's like my kind of target, 3 hours of work a day. But they're all things that I like. But I like to keep up the skill set and the craftsmanship of being a lawyer. I love to travel, so I'm often maybe like 6 weeks a year traveling to wherever.
Yeah, and so you've set yourself up financially.
Oh yeah.
To be able to do those things. 3 hours a week or 3 hours a day goal on the beach, travel 6 weeks a year. Like there's been some very intentional, or has there been intentional, like how do you think about money in terms of allowing you to do that?
Yeah. So I definitely think of money as being like the opportunity, but I would say again, it's mostly just, it's not like anyone taught me to be this way about money. Since I don't have like the willpower, I never end up in a place that, again, is not sustainable. Like I have done before for short periods, jobs that require like immense amounts of effort, you know, time, energy, and for little personal reward. You know, I'm not engaged, personally engaged, and I don't find it interesting. But those things, I know that even if I tried to force myself to do it, you know, for longer than a certain amount of time, that eventually it would just fall apart. And I know that because it has happened exactly like that. Like, right. So after a while, I kind of wised up and realized, well, if I can't force myself to do things that I don't want, then I should just choose to do things I do want. Like that's the better stable thing. Right. And I guess that decision though has, at first I thought that was like a little bit of a risky decision, but that's the decision I think that has led to just having a much better life than I had before. Not just because I'm a psychopath. In some ways, I'm grateful that I'm a psychopath because it's forced me to make choices that are better for me. Like other people do really have the choice of just like sitting with their golden handcuffs and like living a shell of a life, you know, in exchange for like a certain amount of money and security. Right. And I see some of my friends do that. And now I call these people kind of chicken people, you know, people who mostly live their life by fear.
Chicken people?
Yeah.
That's like normal people cheats. We've got all sorts of what's it to keep describing? What's a chicken person?
Like a chicken person is just somebody who is very fear motivated. You know, like almost all their stuff is kind of fearful. They're like fearful of what other people will think of them. So yeah. I think that in terms of chicken people, and I think a lot of people, to get back to money, are that way about money, where they have these reactions to money, but they'd rather not kind of look to the underlying beliefs and expectations that they have about money or the world or their circumstances or other people. They'd rather just kind of assume that everything has to be the way that it is. And that's it's a very limiting belief, I guess. That's what's so sad about the chicken people is that you know, they'd have to change that belief. They'd have to kind of change that belief that you're so kind of hyper invested in the
way. Which is almost like asking somebody to change a core piece of an identity.
Yeah.
Like it's an existential crisis triggering moment if you're saying, hey, look, would you at least examine that?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I'm glad you said existential crisis because I think that's what's so weird about it.
Yeah, and that is how we got onto Chicken People.
Yeah.
Work on the beach 3 hours a day as a goal, travel 6 weeks a year, and only choosing work that you love to do. Is the connection there because, like, look, I don't understand why other people can't make this similar choice. Like, you decided to only do, I think you said you decided to only do the things you really enjoy, and that's worked out for you.
Yeah.
And other people could do that too. Why don't they?
Yes. So I thought about this recently because I normally don't do litigation anymore. I'm only mostly just do like contract work, lawyer work. But I had this piece of litigation that ended up going much farther than I thought it was going, like went all the way through trial. So I'm sitting there writing a brief, you know, the brief ended up being like 40 pages. I had to, because of the deadlines, that's what I don't like about litigation, the strict deadlines. Because of the deadlines, I had to work like a normal person for like 6 days in a row, like normal kind of 8 hour days. I even worked on a Saturday. That was that was one of the days. And then after I was done, I thought, wow, this is just so long since I've done something like this. And I thought, could I do something like this? And I thought, well, not in the long term. And I ended up taking like the next 3 days off or something because I was like,
it's just not sustainable.
Yeah, it wasn't sustainable for me. And so that's kind of been, again, like what I think is like just a blessing in disguise about being a psychopath is because I'm not able to be invested enough in what other people think, or I'm not able to be. Yeah.
That's really interesting, right? Invested enough in what other people think.
Yeah, to just behave that the way that they expect. And it's not that I don't see the appeal of that way of thinking, but it is an illusion. And you know it's an illusion because people opt out all the time. And you are choosing to adopt an illusion as the primary basis for your life choices, you will have to invest so much time and effort into propping up this illusion.
You know it's an illusion because people opt out.
Yeah.
And I think this way of behaving with like Instagram life and the way we consume and the way we use money. I'm really curious as we kind of wrap up, like opting out of the money game, like people who choose not to be chicken people with money. Like when you said, you know it's an illusion because people opt out all the time. How have you or other people you know opted out?
Wow, that is a really good question. I mean, the opting out, how have people opted out? I just think seeing things in terms of like what they truly are, which is just a burden. You know, often when I drive past these like self-storage places, I'm like, what? And you see new ones like building all the time self-storage. And I always just am so amazed. And I'm so kind of, I am a little emotionally triggered by these self-storage places because I will self-soothe myself about them and kind of be like, that's okay. Maybe some of these people have, I literally said this out loud the other day. I said, maybe some of these people have a seasonal business and they're just storing equipment.
That's what it is.
Because I thought that makes more sense because then they you know, they don't want to buy a warehouse and have to whatever. So they just do the self-storage. And, you know, that's probably not true, though. Like, I know when people can kind of see the reality of things, at least specifically, that they are like a burden more than anything else, that they're just like a constant time suck, a constant money suck, a constant space suck, energy suck. I think that's why I like to like live simply and then just travel, is because when you travel, yeah, that takes a lot of time and energy, but you get like the reward and then it's done. It's not like a constant obligation. You know, a thing is like a child, you know, you have to be responsible.
Take care of it, store it.
Yeah.
Feed
it. Yeah. I'm like that way with tortillas at Mexican restaurants for fajitas. I'm not going to use this tortilla. Now I'm responsible.
No,
like,
what burn the tortillas.
Chips or whatever. What? People put like the chips in the thing. You know, you're not going to eat. Those chips are going to taste terrible. Like an hour from now, they're going to get soggy in your little takeout container. You're just doing this because of what, you know? So I really try to catch myself doing things like that where I get kind of caught up in I guess just a pattern of behavior. You know, it's really easy to just kind of get used to doing things a particular way. But I think, again, trying to an audit of like where is your time, energy, money going? And I just think of money as being kind of like electricity. You know, it's just you've taken some resources and you've made it into this thing that's fungible that can go to other purposes, right? So money really is just time and money that you've converted.
It's just the life energy, essentially.
Yeah, exactly.
You can store and trade.
But it's still your time and energy. It was your time and energy at a certain point. So just, you know, thinking of everything kind of in those terms and trying
I love that.
Yeah, trying to understand, just like, you know, our electricity bills are so expensive, and trying to know where your energy vampire is coming from. Is it your TV, old TV that's plugged in, your really old refrigerator and stuff? Yeah. Just trying to be willing to look for these ways in which something's become just kind of a mindless habit for you. But, you know, just like a small change can, in the aggregate of these small changes, make a big difference in the way that you experience your life and kind of the pleasure that you get from your life, because your energy is going to things that maximize your enjoyment, that maximize your life's purpose.
That's so good. Let me just ask one last question. Let's say somebody listens to this, and when they're done, what's the one thing you hope they would remember in terms of like, what do psychopaths have to add in terms of money? Like, what's been valuable for you?
I think that one thing about psychopaths, even though they don't have like internally a sense of self, because they, you know, they're almost impervious to socialization, to, you know, caring about what other people think, they tend to live like very iconoclastic lives. You know, they don't care what other people think. They're not motivated by fear. They just do kind of whatever. And I think that sometimes people don't, they feel like that's kind of morally wrong. And I think if you can just like let go of the idea that you're somehow obligated to do something different with your life, you know, you can just live your own life. It doesn't have to be to the extent that we kind of feel obligated to other people. Let's let it be like actually a good obligation. So I'll give you like another kind of example about this. So I have a friend who's going through a divorce and her family is wealthy and they're like, we'll pray for you. And I was like, why don't they just say that they'll financially support you if your husband stops making the payments? Because that's the only thing she cares about.
Right.
So it's kind of like, you know, we're willing to spend our time, energy, and money, you know, to kind of conform to society, but we're not willing to just loan a friend $15,000 or just give a friend $15,000, which is like, I've been doing that like my freshman year at BYU. I just gave like some random stranger, like, well, she was in my program, but I just knew her like very briefly, like $2,000 so she could pay her tuition so she could keep going to the university. But I was like, well, why wouldn't I give it? You know, I don't need this $2,000 right now. I don't need it until actually next semester when I make my tuition payment. And she just needs it for the next few months, she says. So I just gave it to her. And I've always been that way, where I just think, I don't know, like, are we spending our scarce resources like in the way that it's going to maximize our own kind of happiness? And then I think we'll see that we have actually an abundance that we can just share directly to others, rather than kind of spending it on shoring up this illusion.
So good. Jamie, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, that was amazing.
I have found myself thinking about this interview a lot. Jamie has such a unique perspective on money, and it's not just because she's a psychopath. It's because she's so self-aware. She really knows what drives her own relationship to money and investing, and because of the way her brain works, she's managed to be totally goal-based while remaining emotionally detached. She doesn't seem to experience the anxiety and rumination that so many of us get stuck in when it comes to making our money work for us. So for me, Jamie's story was so inspiring because she invited me to question the societal norms I have built around money, and maybe even the stories that I've been telling myself for decades. As this conversation between Jamie and I sort of bounces around in your head a bit over the next couple of days, here's a few things to think about. What did you take away from the conversation? And specifically, pay attention to the moments where you felt maybe a little challenged or even surprised by something that Jamie said. I find those are the moments worth paying attention to. I have found this particular conversation with Jamie to be really useful as a conversation starter between friends, family, maybe a partner or a spouse. So share this. Remember, I have a goal to start 1 million conversations a month about money. And remember, I'm not talking about budgeting or life insurance or investing. The kind of conversations that matter, the kind of conversations you'd have with a friend in a coffee shop or sitting around a fire. So do me a favor, help me with that goal. Share this conversation between Jamie and I. Pay attention to what stuck out with you so that we can change the way we approach money. Cheers, my friends. 50 Fires is a production of Blind Nil Audio in association with The Roost. If you find this show valuable, and I sure hope you do, please share it with a friend and leave a 6 or 7 or maybe even 8-star review over on Apple Podcasts. It's crazy how much that helps the show get introduced to more people. Speaking of more people, I have a goal that we can use 50 Fires as a spark to start 1 million conversations a month about money. I've heard from so many of you about the conversations you're having around the dinner table, on a road trip in the car, or at your favorite coffee shop, and I think we need more. So if you've got a friend or a family member that you think would benefit from having a conversation about money, or if you happen to give advice for a living, we've created a whole set of free resources. Think of it as a book club about money. It's over at 50fires.com, and you can use it every week. We're updating it every week so that you can help me start 1 million conversations a month about money. I'm looking forward to our next conversation around the fire. Cheers, my friends.
The views, information, or opinions expressed in the series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of Chip and Joanna Gaines, Blind Nil Audio, nor Magnolia.